Hello everyone, this is Musical Headwaters and I'm your host Deanne. And today we have Hilary Tan on the podcast. She's a composer hailing from Wales, currently living in upstate New York, and her pieces have been performed by numerous groups and ensembles around the world. And I think you also currently teach at Union College, am I correct?
I actually retired.
Oh!
In September 2019.
Ah, okay.
And I assumed I would be able to go to all these performances. And then, of course, we had COVID.
Right. It just hit all of us, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I actually got to know your work through the first piece, which is your newest album or discography. And The Snow Did Lie just came out. Yeah. I saw a YouTube recording of it with the Sirius Quartet and with all these visuals. Would you like to talk about that, perhaps? It was very captivating.
Thank you.
Yeah.
When I write music, I think about nature more than anything. Mm-hmm. Nature is my inspiration. And people ask me, how can it be your inspiration? And so when I saw the lithographs, André Bergeron's lithographs, I said, you know, if someone wants to see what inspired me, then they can actually look at this image. And so there were 10 images. And not only were they images, but they had little bits of little phrases attached to the images. So the piece opens with an image of the end of fall, because the piece is called And the Snow Did Lie, and really it takes place from the end of fall to after the snow has fallen, and then when the snow-filled landscape begins to flood, because now we're back in the spring. So it takes place over that time. And so the piece opens with the ragged earth, because the earth has to go to sleep before we can have the snow. And if you, when you listen to the opening of the piece, it feels a little ragged, I hope, you know. So people could say, oh, this is the ragged earth. And the end of the first movement has the sky dark with birds. And that inspired a lot of trilling and moving up the strings and so on.
Yeah. Where are the words from? Is it also from poetry?
No, it's from a novel called Le Souvenant, The Outsider. And apparently that novel was a TV series in Canada at one point. I mean, based on the novel. And Bergeron, who is from Montreal, he took the descriptive parts of the novel and then excerpted these tiny bits. It's quite interesting. He came to Union to show his lithographs at one point, and he has a set of images which are called bord de terre, the edge of the earth. And of course, I have a piece called Water's Edge. And so we connected. We seem to have the same channel to inspiration.
Yeah, how do you incorporate, because that concerning this piece, then there are so many elements and, you know, visual parts and also the poetic part, so the words. And then you have your musical elements. How do you manage that, so many influences, and then still be able to put it into one thing at the end?
So when I originally thought of the piece, I was in Montreal, and it turns out that the Philadelphia Orchestra plays in Montreal, and it also plays nearby in Saratoga. And I went to a performance of the orchestra, and in the background, they had a scrim, and they showed images on the scrim during a performance. And I thought, my gosh, I want to do that.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, but, you know, then we had 9/11, and things got, orchestras stopped being so adventuresome. And so what you hear in And the Snow Did Lie is really, it's as though it's a condensed orchestra. because I was thinking in orchestral terms, and then I had to put the piece on. I never wrote the orchestra piece, but it seems to me when I listen to the piece that it's kind of bursting out of its out of traditional string quartet writing, let's put it that way. So the piece itself, there are 10 images, and the last one is really an exit image, and the piece falls into three large sections, and the first ends with the birds, and the second, which I like hugely, is when we're dealing with the snow and the softness of it. And the people are leaving church at one point, and I quote, or I make reference to a French-Canadian hymn called Picardie, which was kind of fun to put in there. And then everything loosens up when we get to spring, and so there's a real sense that there's a natural flow, as it were, through the three movements.
Yeah, I really enjoyed listening to that, and the quartet also did a great job.
The quartet is fantastic.
It
really helped that they liked the piece.
Always.
Well, you know, they're professionals, and they will play, but they really liked that piece. And then it was recorded in Boston, and I have purchased a set of those lithographs, and they're quite large. And so I was able to put them on a long bench in the room where they were doing the recording. So when they had a question about something, I could actually point to a lithograph, and I could say, oh, well, you see, this is dusk, and therefore, whatever. You know?
Oh, that's so lovely.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was helpful because I think there are many composers that say they are quote-unquote nature composers. And you wonder, or I wonder, what that means. I mean, it could mean the sort of thing that Beethoven does in the Pastoral Symphony. And you could quote birds, or you could mimic animals, but that's not what I do.
I see. How would you distinguish what you do personally?
So that's That's a big question.
Yeah.
Okay. If someone is really interested, I have an article on my website, which can be accessed on the bio page.
Okay.
And in that article, I ask a friend of mine, who is a philosopher, to make me answer this question.
Oh, wow.
But I asked him to be a curmudgeon.
Okay.
In other words, I asked him to give me difficult questions. And he said he thought it was ridiculous to have the listening experience dependent on a natural image. He said that he's listened to my music and he's never bothered to read the program note. And he likes the music anyway. And I've said, well, if you read the program note, then you'll have a fuller sense of the music and you'll know what inspired it. And we pretty much came to the conclusion that there are those who would find this really interesting and others for whom it wasn't that interesting. Okay. So, I mean, let's go back to the Beethoven. I mean, are we going to say that the brook in the second movement is watery or has repeated patterns that are soothing? The watery one is going to echo what Beethoven was thinking. But, soothing three note figures repeated would also capture some of this. So I find with performers, sometimes I can say to a performer, I'd like this to sound more like a landscape. and the performer says, looks at me and says, do you want me to play louder or softer?
Right, yeah. What's the dynamic kind of thing?
Right, what's the dynamic? How much vibrato? So there are performers that like to be talked to that way.
Right.
But there are other performers, and Eunmi Ko is one of them. And I can say to Eunmi, I need this to be representative of the Adirondack Mountains. It's full of fifths, and would you give it that strength? And for her, that's real communication.
Yeah, like the thing that kind of have a visual imagery of things.
Yeah, and I don't think it's special to me. We've talked about program music and absolute music for a long time.
Yes.
I would say that I'm on the programmatic side of things, obviously.
Right.
And I'm more on the secret side of things.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't have any backbeat. I don't have pounding rhythms. it's not something that I do.
Yeah.
In fact, the piece that will be performed at Camp 22 was commissioned as a piece for a violin, solo violin, and percussion ensemble. And I actually heard the first rehearsal that was before the COVID hit with Bob McCormack. And I loved hearing it. But the title of the piece is No Wind Yet Leaves Fall.
No Wind Yet Leaves Hall.
Fall.
Fall.
That leaves fall. Because I'd been at Bard and I was walking back about this time of year. It was in the moonlight. And I could hear the oak leaves falling in the forest, but there was no wind. It was just their time to fall. So my piece for solo violin and seven percussion really deals with rhythmical events that aren't repetitive.
I see.
Right. So so the way waves come in, you can have larger and smaller ones. They're not rhythmical, right? The way the leaves fall, that's not rhythmical. It's textural, but it's not rhythmical. And I was thinking about in Holland, the windmills there kind of click at different rates.
Oh.
And so you're not doing additive rhythm.
Okay.
You're just doing textural rhythm.
Right.
And Robert McCormack said he really enjoyed working with my piece. I was using shells and all sorts of I didn't have a drum set around.
I see. Yeah. No beats or anything.
So it, the whole piece has to do with texture, really, and more the sounds of nature, the sounds that I hear in nature.
Yeah, natural rhythm of things, and yeah.
Yes, except it's rhythm, but it's not rhythmical.
Yeah.
Right. It's that's why I think of it as a rhythm texture, mm-hmm. rather than marching in step.
Right.
You know?
that's great. That's so serene to hear. Lovely. Yeah. I mean, I do notice a lot of nature references in your works, and also somehow spirituality, perhaps folklore a little bit, and also associations with poems and poetry. And I read that you're a haiku, published haiku author. That's amazing.
Well, it's interesting because being a composer, I'm always thinking about the future. I mean, that composers face the void, right? Performers don't. They turn the page.
Right. Yeah.
But composers are saying, "Okay, I'm here, and how can?" Not even what's next. What's next, and even further next, and so
yeah.
on. Right? And what my interest in haiku does is to pull me back to the moment.
I see.
Because the haiku is thought of as one breath poetry. It's sort of the aha moment. But both haiku and for me, composition share something else, which is, a Zen idea, which is about the interconnectedness of things. So, for example, if I said, this is a haiku of mine, overwintering their different ways, birch and pine. Overwintering their different ways, birch and pine. Right, so you have the image of the birch, in order to overwinter, loses its leaves. It says, no leaves, right?
Right.
And the pine, on the other hand, it keeps its leaves.
Oh, right.
Okay, so they overwinter in different ways.
Ah, I see.
But people will face adversity in different ways. So there are those of us that drop everything, as it were. And then there are those of us that try to hold on to as much as we can. So there's a parallel in between the natural world and the human world. That's what I mean by interconnectedness.
Oh, I see.
Okay. I have a friend, John Stevenson, who is a well-known haiku poet, has many books, and was once president of the Haiku Society of America. So he's way up there. Anyway, he has a haiku, which I like, and this is his haiku. A deep gorge. Some of the silence is me. A deep gorge. Some of the silence is me.
Ah, that's one to think about.
So I actually have a piece. I asked John if I could use his poem. I have a piece, believe it or not, for four saxophones, for saxophone quartet. And it's called Some of the Silence. Okay? And it's sort of interesting because I was a participant in a world saxophone congress. I had two concertos played, believe it or not, one with orchestra and one with piano. The result of me going to the World Saxophone Congress and listening to saxophones for a whole week, the result was, when I was asked to write for saxophone quartet, I decided I really should write for quiet saxophone quartet.
As a result.
As a result of it.
Yes.
Because quiet classical saxophones are really beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, it was to be a classical. It wasn't, I don't do jazz, but it wasn't to be jazzy. It was for classical saxophone. So the piece, Some of the Silence Is Me, had to do with coming upon something and then reacting to it in this piece, three different ways.
Wow.
And so the first reaction is, oh my gosh, there's a big gorge there. <You know? laughs> And the second reaction is to see how the gorge was formed and how it flowed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how the water that made it flowed. And then the third reaction, or the third response, was to be reconciled. And so the stuff that was kind of scattered in the first response becomes melodic in the third response. And I I like that. I you've probably read that I've spent time in Japan.
Yes.
And I've spent time with Japanese music.
Yeah.
And Japanese music is based on, this is a big generalization, but it is based on what's called a Jōhaku curve. All right, which is a rising, something climactic, and then you tie the thing up at the end. But it's a round curve, and one thing that I like about the Jōhaku curve is that right at the top, there's something called a Honshirashi, which is where the wave breaks. And that's exciting to me as a composer, because so much music in the West just lands somewhere.
Right. Boom, boom,
boom, bim, bim. And it's like, wait a minute, you know, nature doesn't land somewhere.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's always this flow.
Yes.
So I think I spend a lot of time thinking about how to get out of climactic material without simply hitting the bass drum.
Yeah. Oh, I see. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Right. So yeah. You can see how I was attracted to, a deep gorge, some of the silence is me. You know, that's because it dealt with the after effect of something, which I think is equally well, which I love working with. I love working, I've done my job as a composer, I've got something happening, but coming out of it is so important.
I see.
Letting it breathe.
Right. You know? That's lovely. Some of the title of the piece is Some
of the Silence. That's the
Some
title.
Some of the Silence. All right. I had to look that up.
I asked my friend if he was willing for me to use that, and he was willing. So
lovely. That's so wonderful. Yeah. And bringing us to another piece with saxophone that I know of, because of Umi, the co-founder of CAMP, and I think she recently performed this with also another guest performer for CAMP, Dr. Catherine Wendorf-Pierce, in Tampa, in the first spinning place. This is another piece with Alton Sax. Right, and I think also there are different versions of this piece, one with piano, one with orchestra.
No, not only that, but I... Yeah.
They're further.
I was asked to do one for, I guess it's wind band. So it's actually exists in three versions.
Wow.
But it was originally... commissioned for NASA 2000.
Oh.
Right, but NASA isn't what you think NASA is.
Oh, okay.
NASA is the North American Saxophone Alliance.
I see. The other NASA.
Right, the other one.
Yeah.
So in the first spinning place, There are some stories about this, and it was performed at Arizona State University, conducted by Jingdong Tsai, a NASA meeting is one where the saxophonists kind of show off to each other.
Yeah, an instrumental festival.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think I was listed as a collaborative artist.
Lovely.
It's interesting. Anyway, the saxophone soloist was, or was, and she's recorded both versions. So Deborah Richtmeyer, and she's really well known, and she's such a professional. So I got ready to write this piece, I got ready to write this piece, and when I had it in pencil score, she decided that she would fly out from Champaign-Urbana and to visit me to look at the piece, basically, and so we shared the cost of her flight. She came, and I played the piece to her as best I could on still using piano at that time,
right? Yeah.
Rather than a computer. And she said she wanted it to be a little more virtuoso. Could she have a few more virtuoso things?
A bit more licks in there.
Yeah, more licks in there. So in fact, it got pretty exciting, you know. I realized that was, you know, something as a composer that I should think about, is that the performer has a right to ask to display his her skills, you know, which is interesting. The title is from a poem, and the poem is by probably Wales' most famous poet, Dylan Thomas.
Yes.
And the three sections, you can tell there's a certain pattern here, but anyway, yes. Three sections of the piece. The first, the poem is called Fern Hill, and I thought I might use that as a title, but it turns out that poem has been set a number of times, so I didn't want to have another Fern Hill. The first movement is it has to do with a young boy and his enjoyment of a certain landscape in South Wales, and his excitement, and the first movement is down the rivers of the windfall light. Down the rivers of the windfall light. And windfall in this instance means the apples that have fallen from the trees.
Uh-huh.
Late again, about this time.
Fall, yeah.
I don't know. I must be an autumn person somehow.
Beautiful season.
Down the rivers of the windfall light. So beepa bee da da dee da dee da dee da. You know it. So the first movement kind of bounces along like that. And then the second movement, which is, I mean, they're all, it's one piece. But anyway, the second movement refers to the pebbles of the holy streams, and so it suggested bell sounds and those triplets. That's another sound, okay?
Yeah.
And then the last movement is called In the First Spinning Place. So the question is, how could I work with the idea of spinning in a piece? Like, when do you notice that something is spinning? And I decided that it was probably when the something spinning wobbled. So, yeah, so it goes. So that was a fast movement. And it had virtuoso it had a real virtuoso element. I went to the first rehearsal in Tucson, and after the first rehearsal I was pleased with the orchestra. I was pleased with Deborah, with the soloist. I was pleased with the conductor. But the soloist and the conductor came to me and they said, "We think this piece should end."
Oh, interesting. All right.
And I said, "What do you mean?" And they said, "Well, it doesn't really end." And I said, "But the first spinning place is the earth spinning in space. That's what it is. I can't end the earth." And so the end of the piece, basically, it's as though you withdraw the camera from the spinning earth so that you know the earth keeps spinning, for gosh sake.
Yeah. I see. Yeah, it's kind of like the lens zooms out and
that's one right.
exits. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And so
oh no.
So they finally agreed that they thought they could make it work, and oh, and indeed it has worked.
Yeah.
The idea of, I mean, imagine you have all these sextuplet sixteenths rushing around the place, and now what you're going to do? Are you going to change them into eighth notes, or I mean, how could I possibly stop the thing? Now you know how the nature side of me determines the music side of me,
right.
because it was absolutely inconceivable.
Doesn't just cut off like this, but it just continues on with probably in another realm, kind of.
Yes. Exactly.
Well.
Anyway, it's been the saxophone players seem to like it, and Deborah did play it with piano in that World Saxophone Congress, and Unni says she liked it.
Yeah,
which I'm pleased.
Yeah,
I'm pleased about
this recent performance was in Tampa, and she must have done it a few times probably. Yeah, lovely.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And then bringing it back to Wales, the Malango variations. Malango variations, yeah. This is sort of inspired by your hometown or home country.
Yes. Okay, so because I value poetry so much, it's quite difficult for me to set words. So I have to be really careful about the words I set. And I would say that in the past, I have been more an orchestral and chamber music composer. It turns out recently that I've had commissions for a number of vocal works, and I think I'm I think I'm getting better at it. Anyway, have you heard this piece?
Yeah.
Yes, and I think it's, in a way, it's a lighter piece, and you know, when you have a vocalist in the ensemble, you really don't want to mess that person up with a lot of stuff. You really need to help the vocalist, the soloist. So the person who commissioned this, it was commissioned for the Beaumaris Festival, which is in North Wales. The person who commissioned this was Jeremy Hugh Williams, and he had been quote unquote after me for a piece for quite a while, and he always wanted a piece with piano, and I don't know what your instrument is, but I really like writing for strings and so on. So finally, this was a piece commissioned for string orchestra, and then he wanted it for baritone, mezzo, and soprano. And I said to him, if I write for baritone, mezzo, and soprano, a 10-minute piece, that's really expensive for people to put on. You know, you can't just bring in three soloists like that. So we decided that, or between us, we decided that we would write for baritone and soprano, but that the soprano line could be performed by an instrument. So that was a real challenge. In other words, you'd have just one soloist, and then if we could have the soprano, great. If we couldn't have the soprano, then a melody instrument could take mm-hmm. over. Okay.
I see. Yeah.
So actually, it's been done with violin as the instrument, with cor anglais as the instrument, mm-hmm. with oboe d'amore as the instrument. The instrument. So yeah. The first movement of that piece refers to a chant, Veni Sancta Spiritus. And of course, a chant can be heard as chant-like if it's done by a soloist singing the words, or even if it's just done by a melody instrument. Okay, so that solved that one. And the second movement had the poet, the wonderful Gwyneth Lewis, who was a Nobel laureate in Wales at one point. In the second movement, Gwyneth Lewis refers to breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. Because the saint Melanger, has been pursued into a bush by hounds, and she has to be very still there. Okay. And so I was able to echo the breathing, as it were, or the lines that represented the breathing. And then in the last piece, The Cloud of Witnesses, I had the baritone soloist half speak the names of the saints that were the cloud of witnesses. So, and then of course, Jeremy asked me after it had been, and actually before it was even performed, he said he would like a piano version of it.
All right.
So I had to create a piano version of it, which when I think of a piano as an orchestra manque, I know I'm not thinking of a piano as Unni would think of a piano, but it's about the only way that I can work with piano sounds. Otherwise, I think I have to, I think of all the piano music that I've known in my life and that I've taught and that I've played, and it seems overwhelming to write for that instrument. But if what I have to do is to say, okay, we'll do a piano version of this piece, that's easier for me, and it encourages me to look for different kinds of piano sounds. I often hold down something and then play so that the resonance comes out of the piano and so on. Or I'll use the piano more as a percussion instrument, which I don't know how kind that is to pianists, but that's the way that I think of it.
Yeah, I've never even considered that the piano can be a very difficult instrument to write for, but that...
I remember when I was 10, I had started playing cello and I played piano.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother and I went to a store in Cardiff, Wales. And while my mother was buying the stuff that were needed for the next exam, I thumbed through some sheet music. And I saw there the Fingal's Cave Overture, the Hebrides Overture by Mendelssohn. And I took it home and started playing it as best I could. I had never before understood that the same notes that were on the orchestra were on the piano. I always thought of it as being completely other, because the orchestra was so orchestral.
Yeah.
I don't think I've gotten over the dichotomy quite.
Right. The piano can be a whole orchestra in itself.
Right.
Yeah. True. Yeah.
Just again, the last thing about the variations. Jeremy decided to record them on CD. However, he gave me a choice. I could either use a piano or a string quartet. So the next thing I knew, I was doing a version for a string quartet. Again, it exists in three different forms.
Wow. Yeah, this is, I did find that a lot of your works exist in so many different variations. And lastly, what are you working on now? Any new works?
The one I'm working on now is a piece for the 21st Century Consort, which is a Washington, D.C. based group. And the commission was for clarinet, violin, viola, cello, and piano. And I asked the commissioner, I said, are you sure you want a piano? And he said, yes, I like your piano writing.
Well, there you go.
There I go. Right. So, but he wanted the clarinet to be featured.
I see.
So I'm writing a piece and I'm saying it's called In the Enchantment, but I'm saying it's for clarinet and piano quartet. So I'm trying to, right, rather than for mixed quintet.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean? So that I can think of the clarinet as being soloistic, and then the strings with the piano sort of behind as being not the orchestra, but the accompanying instruments, the commentating instruments, and so on. So it's really focused on that. It's based on five trees. So it's based on a poem by a 6th century Welsh poet called Taliesin. And he refers to the different trees, and in the Celtic alphabet, the different trees are different letters. So birch is the first letter of the Celtic alphabet, as it were.
Oh wow!
So I'm writing. I've just finished birch. I'm about to do rowan, oak, aspen, and then yew. So that's
so nice.
I hope so.
Yeah.
So I and these trees were in my home in Wales, and they are also found in the Adirondacks. So I have a link. And when I first moved here, I asked my husband if he would be willing to plant birches and rowans, and he was. And now I can just look out of my window and see the trees that I am writing about.
Oh, that's so nice. Wow. And that's amazing. So the Welsh, if I understand correctly, the Welsh alphabet is associated with different trees.
Yes, it's called the Ogham alphabet, and the trees are, so the birch is the tree of new beginnings and the tree of the woodland. And rowan is known as the lady of the mountain.
Oh,
wow. Oak is the king of the forest.
Yeah.
And then aspen is a sacred Celtic whispering tree. Because, you know, the leaves of the aspen move like this, right?
Oh, yeah.
They move. And there are many, many stories about aspens, and we don't have time for them. But you can see that in the case of my Japanese curve, the king of the forest will be the strong part of the curve. And then the aspen is supposed to communicate with the next world. So I can go there. And then the last one is the yew, which is of the winter solstice and renewal again. So you can see how there's sort of nature in there and there's poetry in there. And I hope soon there'll be a lot of music in there.
Oh, wow. That's beautiful. I really look forward to hearing that when that's out.
Super. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. So thank you very much for being on here today. So lovely to talk to you.
It's been a pleasure. And I'm glad we were able to look at each other, even though it's a podcast.
Yeah.
you can see I talk with my hands a lot, so.
That's great. Yeah. Unfortunately for the listeners, it will only be audio, but it's great that we got to connect through a video as well.
Will I see you in March?
Yeah, so I will be one of the guest performers in Florida. So I'm coming over to the States.
Lovely.
Yeah. Are you also coming to the camp festival in March?
Yes, you bet.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
We'll meet each other.
Yeah, lovely. So super looking forward to that. And for everyone else that's listening, the camp festival is in March in Temple, in Florida. Yeah. Well, thank you so much today, Hillary.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.